The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Gloria America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Thursday, May the 19th in the year of our Lord 2022. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Number one story on the top of most people's mind is the stock market. I'll come to it in a second, but let me update the Pennsylvania Senate race for you between Dr. Oz and Dave McCormick, who are locked in an ongoing battle that probably will not be resolved for 3 weeks. But if you're a McCormick fan, and I am, the news was good yesterday. I'll read you Jeff Rowe, who is Dave McCormick's chief consultant's tweet of 7 hours ago. At the end of last night, Dave was down 2,752 votes, meaning Tuesday night. Today, roughly 10,000 out of 33,000 absentee ballot votes were counted. And we, meaning the McCormick campaign, averaged a 10% victory, closing the gap by 1,509 votes. Dave is now only down 1,243 votes, with an estimated 20,000 GOP absentee votes left to count. Dave is going to win. You'd rather be Dave McCormick with those numbers and that trend line than you'd rather be Dr. Oz. And both Dwayne and I did the algebra. It's a ratio. And, of course, Dwayne got it right and I got it wrong. But when we compared notes, it looks like, if everything holds the same, that at the end of round one, there'll be a recount, mandatory recount. McCormick should win by 2,200 votes. I had him winning by 409 votes, and I had the wrong denominator. There are a couple of horseshoes in there that might come close, but not close enough. One is Lancaster County's all screwed up. Another is Allegheny County is not all absentee ballots are out. There they have 30-odd precincts that have been counted. But Allegheny County is Dave McCormick's home. So one would assume he's going to win those. But we'll know more tomorrow morning, and we'll know a lot more Monday, and then there will be a recount. Now, remember my rule from the book I wrote, bestseller, New York Times bestseller, if it's not close, they can't cheat. The bottom line, if a race is not within 1,000 votes, you can't win it on a recount. Can't be done. It's never been done. So if the math holds and McCormick is up 2,200, it'll be a very safe recount. People just don't make four-digit errors, given the number of tallies and retallies being done. And the McCormick people are very happy this morning. Other news. Vladimir Putin is weaponizing the world's food supplies. The Kremlin is believed to be dismantling infrastructure needed for food production and blockading ports that are vital in shipping cereals out of the country. Officials fear Russia has embarked on a deliberate policy of disrupting food supplies, sparking a global crisis, raising the prospect of starvation in developing countries. Look, that's Putin. He's an evil thug, as Dick Cheney said years ago. I looked into his eyes. I saw a KGB colonel. He does not care. He is a sociopath. And, a very effective sociopath, but a sociopath. If you say the Zodiac killer was a pretty good killer, that doesn't make him a good man. Putin's just a good killer. And so he's decided to punish the world because, you know, reports are he's dying, but nobody knows. Meanwhile, Turkey's Erdogan is blocking the quick accession of Sweden and Finland into NATO. He's done so probably as a negotiating point to get some anti-Erdogan people out of those countries. He attacked the Western allies for not respecting Ankara's sensitivity. There are 30 people in those two countries accused of terrorism-related charges in his country. And they're going to have to talk about that. Admiral Stavridis thought that would go away. International investors are dumping Chinese debt as fast as they can. The people don't believe in it. That is really quite remarkable as well. Got another China story here. They've got, I missed this, the Financial Times headline is U.S. stocks suffer worst day since the early months of the pandemic. Dow slides more than 1,100 points and worst day since 2020, and so on. The China story I was looking for is that the housing prices are falling in China, which is a sign that the average Chinese consumer believes their economy is in bad shape, too. Moreover, a senior Chinese central banker is under investigation for corruption. Shock, shock, shock. Mr. Sun. Mr. Sun is apparently a bad guy. And Mr. Xi Jinping wants to be president for a third time, but his country is teetering on the brink of everything being wrong. Danny Danon, who was the UN special ambassador from the ambassador to the UN from Israel, has released a new book calling the Obama administration cowardly. That's not news. I just thought I'd emphasize that. The Washington Post has a story, House to vote on legislation aimed at curbing domestic terrorism. Once again, New York had a red flag law. It was not applied. The kid who killed in Buffalo, the white supremacist, he ought to have been on a do not sell list. I say enforce the laws we've got. If you can't do it in New York, what makes you think a House resolution will work? It won't. And COVID is coming back, but it's the less virulent sort. That's the good news. That's the rundown. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning glory, America. Bonjour. I can't take Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. Some things always catch my eye. And when a Republican works with a Democrat, especially if that Democrat is Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, I wonder what's going on. But Senator Bill Hagerty of the great state of Tennessee joins me because he and Mazie have a mutual interest in the Pacific Island nations that we've long ignored, and they matter because of China. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hugh, it's always great to be on with you. Good morning to you.
Can you explain a little bit to me what you and Senator Hirono are up to?
Well, I think we see the region and the whole Indo-Pacific as extremely strategic and vital to America. We see China's very aggressive posture. Just look what they've recently done in the Solomon Islands, signing a security agreement with the Solomon Islands. They are trying to use their typical means of corruption, the debt trap diplomacy that they deploy, et cetera, to get more of these smaller nations to fall their way, whether it's to put pressure on Taiwan, whether it's to get more votes in these multilateral organizations like the United Nations. I think the United States needs to be more present, and we need to have more connectivity in that region. We certainly have, a major presence in Japan, you're well aware of. You and I have talked about it many times before, but the largest component of U.S. military stationed anywhere is based in Japan, where I served as U.S. ambassador most recently. And we have, incredible strategic interest in the region. It's a vital area for growth, the busy sea lanes in the world, East China Sea, South China Sea. Our interests are very much aligned with keeping a free and open region there in the Pacific.
And I also think keeping China investment out. I'm going to come back to the Solomon Islands, but what do you and the senator specifically propose in terms of spending and bases and things like that?
We're looking at extending our presence and studying where we can make the most the most impact there, making certain that we have free market financing available for infrastructure is something I worked on again when I served as U.S. ambassador. We put together a consortium with the United States, Japan, and Australia to provide an alternative to China's Belt and Road financing in the region. What we're mainly trying to do is use private sector funds and basically lead the way and demonstrate the fact that America is present. If you add up all of the private investment that has been made in the region, America is still by far the largest investor, but we need to keep that going because China is making what I would say are strategic investments in the region, Hugh, meaning they may not have a profit motive, but they certainly have a motive that is consistent with China's strategy to dominate the region. We need to be there. We need to be present. We need to put it back.
Now, Senator, I don't think the Steelers fans out there who listen in great numbers have any idea where the Solomon Islands are, because I don't have any idea where they are other than they're in the Pacific and they're a long way away. What are we doing about that Chinese play there? Because I know that they mattered a lot in World War II, and I think that's the last time I've read about them is at the fleet at full tide. What are we trying to do to upend that approach by China to the Solomon Islands?
Well, our concern is that China takes its agreement that they struck with the Solomon Islands for, quote, defense and turns that into a basing proposition where they actually put a military presence in place. So we're in the process of putting a diplomatic presence there so that we are physically, we physically have diplomats in the area that we can push back. We can work with the Solomon Island government, let them know, yes, America and her allies care about the region as well. I'm going to be looking for opportunities to work together with the people there so that China isn't their only alternative.
Let's turn to the mainland. Financial Times reports this morning that international investors are selling Chinese debt at a record pace. They also report in the Telegraph that the Chinese housing market has for the first time in decades gone backwards, that they're not able to interest the average Chinese consumer in a small lot purchase in one of the minor cities, which is the canary in the coal mine there. Are we dealing with a potentially catastrophic economic situation in China, Bill Hagerty, because that won't stay in China?
China has got some major problems. I think part of it goes to the demographic situation there. You know they've got just this massive demographic hole because of their one-child policy. And they've got an aging population, a birth rate that's below replacement rate right now. And they're going to have a very difficult time maintaining support for the elderly population as it moves forward. You begin to see that manifest itself in the housing market. But I think there are other reasons for this too. China has certainly gone to this zero COVID policy because they have not vaccinated the more vulnerable people in their own population. That's caused massive shutdowns, massive economic dislocation. That's very hard to recover from. And their way to recover from it in China is to make more infrastructure investment. Well, many of the Chinese infrastructure investments might be good ego projects for Chinese leadership, but they don't have real economic value. So I think it's misallocation of resources within the country. It's demographic problems. It's their reaction to the COVID pandemic, which, had things been different in Wuhan and they not spread it, we might be in a very different place right now. So China's dealing with it on all fronts.
Their top anti-corruption agency, according to the Wall Street Journal this morning, also announced they are investigating a senior Chinese central banker, Mr. Sun, for suspected leaking of official economic statistics. It's a corrupt state. I think you know that. I know that. Everyone who listens to us knows that. But Xi Jinping has managed to manage the corruption. Is he losing his grip?
Well, he's used the corruption police there, if you will, Hugh, to knock out his opposition, right, left, and center. That's what it means. If they're investigating someone for, quote, corruption, it means that there is somebody that's not on board with Xi Jinping, and that typically is the case, at least. And I would not be surprised at all if this data weren't embarrassing to the Chinese government, so this is their means of punishing them.
Now, in terms of Japan, I just finished watching Tokyo Vice, which is sent 20 years ago, and it's a fascinating bit of production. It really takes me inside of what it's like to live in Japan. It reminds me of my only time there visiting family when they were stationed abroad in China, in Japan. What is going on in that government? Have they settled down into the next era of leadership? Have they become more robust in their defense spending, Senator?
Well, I regret to say I've not had time yet to see Tokyo Vice. I hear great things about it. One of my good friends, Bob Whiting, wrote a book called Tokyo Underworld many years ago, and it provided tremendous insight in terms of how things worked in Japan, probably 20 years even before the time that Tokyo Vice was set. But if you think about what's happening right now in the government, we're seeing a transition from the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history, that was Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, to the new government. Now we went through Prime Minister Suga, now we're in Prime Minister Kishida's government. And what we've seen is, a real break with some of the former positions that Japan had taken. The first one I'll start with is Russia. Prime Minister Abe spent years trying to negotiate with Vladimir Putin. His hope was to regain negotiating posture relative to what Japan calls the Northern Territories. These are islands that have been in dispute since the end of World War II. Russia has claimed them, Japan claims them, but Russia has taken more of a presence on those islands, forcing Japan to negotiate. Putin always let Prime Minister Abe have a little bit of rope, but never would come to the table really in any serious fashion to negotiate about the islands. But Abe was always cautious not to take a position that would be counter to Russia's interest, so he could leave that option open. Prime Minister Kishida now has basically said, I know the Russians aren't going to be there at the table, and the right thing to do is to side with the rest of the world in terms of sanctioning Russia over Ukraine. So we saw Japan step up and do that. We saw Japan step up and say, we're going to significantly increase our defense budget. This is something that America's wanted to see. They're going to go from 1% of GDP to 2% of GDP. When I was in Japan just a few weeks ago, leading the first bipartisan congressional delegation there since the pandemic began, I emphasize this need not be just a procurement exercise. use those funds to get more interoperable, get more coordinated with America, more training exercises. Let's make certain that we are fully leveraging everything that we have in America with what you can bring to the table in Japan, because together we're going to stand far stronger. And everyone I met with in Japan agreed that was the right posture.
Now, Senator, I left it to the end because I want everyone to hear what a realist you are on foreign policy. You and I disagree on aid to Ukraine. You voted against the Ukraine package. I would have voted for it twice if they would have allowed me if I was in the United States Senate. Why did you do that?
Well, we may not disagree on supporting Ukraine, but the magnitude of it, the timing of it, the fact that it didn't move through any sort of committee process, it's not checked. There are many, many aspects of it that I have difficulty with that are in the bill itself. Challenge that I have right now is this administration's desire to rush into situations overseas. We're jumping well ahead of our European partners here, putting, you know, 4x the amount of money up, again, that Europe has done at this point. And we're doing this at a time when we have massive problems at home. We've got an administration that will not do anything about our southern border, which I think is the greatest national security crisis we face right now. And that's all self-induced. We've had over 160 different nationalities apprehended coming across that border, trying to sneak across that border since Joe Biden took office. We've got massive inflation here at home. We've got, you know, shortages of critical food supplies in Tennessee. We've got children, you know, hospitalized because they can't get formula. And you've got a much simpler, more straightforward answer right in front of us. Joe Biden should stop the war on American energy. He should get us back into the energy business right away, send those signals to the capital markets, bring global energy prices down. That would defund Putin's war in the Ukraine, and it would also address inflation here. We presented with only one choice, which is throw $40 billion into it. There are much better choices that we can pursue, and that's the message I want to send back to the administration.
If it comes back around, will you support it? We got 30 seconds, Senator.
Not at this level. Not at this level. Not at this content of this process.
We're going to have to disagree, Senator Bill Hagerty. That's a rare thing, but I'm glad you came on to talk about it. Bill Hagerty from Tennessee. Thank you, Senator. Coming right back. America, stay tuned. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Meretz MK Rinaway Zoabi has quit the governing coalition in Israel, making it now a minority and no longer have 60 votes. I'm joined by Jim Talent, a longtime observer of all things Israel and international. That's breaking news, Senator, so I wanted to bring it up to you. That is an unstable government in Israel. Any thoughts on this?
Well, the thoughts I get are often derived from listening to you interview Michael Oren. But, I mean, I don't see how it survives past the budget, the government past the budget next year, because they're not going to be able to pass it. And then the government will fall. So it was inherently unstable from the beginning because it was based on the idea that Bibi Netanyahu should not be prime minister. And other than that, the members of the coalition really have nothing in common. So when they actually try to govern, they're going to disagree all the time. This was probably inevitable. I mean, I read the same things you read about Israel, and people just were really asking themselves not whether it would last, but how long it would last.
Yeah, the members of the coalition are begging this individual to come back. They're not going to come back after you get crushed for crossing the line twice. So they got to go to elections at a minimum. Senator, I was talking with Bill Hagerty, who I like and respect a great deal. The man's very experienced, but he voted against the Ukraine Aid Act, $40 billion. He said it's too much. What did you think of that vote, and what do you think of that?
Well, I would have aid voted visit? For it. And it's a basic principle, you, that the adversary of my adversary is my ally, okay? Vladimir Putin has made his government and his regime an adversary of the United States, constantly attacking us in the cyber world, going back to 1996 with the Moonlight Maze attack that just looted our government agencies of all kinds of information. The biggest safe harbor for cyber criminals. You remember the Colonial Pipeline, the meat processing attacks, right? is engage in constant cyber warfare or, and hybrid warfare against our Baltic allies, including military threats, overflights, threats on the high seas. His intervention in the Middle East opened up a way for Iran to more easily resupply Hezbollah to destabilize the Middle East. It was a big cause of the refugee crisis that destabilized Europe. And now, you know, he's signed an unlimited friendship partnership with China. So he's done us harm. He will continue to do us harm to the extent he has the resources. And this is a real opportunity for us to reduce his ability to attack the security and interests of the United States going forward. So to me, you know, it's very much in our interest to support the Ukrainians, who, of course, have the right on their side. Now, let me just say, and then I'm filibustering you a bit, I sympathize with the concerns about how quickly the bill was passed and the size of it. And I think that the leaders of Congress would be well advised if they can get a bigger consensus to break these bills up a little bit and give people more time to study them. I'm sympathetic with what Senator Hagerty says about that.
Well, I am too, but I also think that when Lend-Lease was on the table, we didn't argue about a billion here and a billion there, or 10 right. billion here and 10 billion there. You get them what they need because they're on the brink of maybe pushing them back in Donbass and certainly halting them. Last thing I got to talk to you about, you've run for election a lot. Gas will now cost an American $4,800 a year. That's up $2,000 a year in 1 year. What does that mean for Democrats in November? I mean, this is catastrophic politically. Don't they see that?
Well, yeah, which is why Granholm is saying the kinds of things she's saying, that, oh, well, we're really doing all this to increase supply at the same time as they're suppressing supply. I loved your statement about it, and I'm glad you featured what Ted Cruz said. This is not a bug in their policy. It's a feature. And I used to say on the campaign trail all the time that when they talk about climate change policy, what they mean and what you should hear if you're a voter is they want to increase the price of energy and, by the way, reduce its reliability, which hurts people. I mean, this, I'm glad Ted said it the way he said it. It hurts people. People who are trying to figure out which bills to juggle at the end of the month, and now the price of their gas, as it has in Missouri, is doubled. And you have to buy it to get to work.
Yeah. Do you think, Senator, that the problem, my theory is that the problem, people who could okay more production have enough resilience in their budget that they can pay whatever it costs at the pump, so they don't understand. Do you agree with me on that?
Well, I think part of it is that they're not connected. And I think a lot of it is, it's what, when Tom Cotton talked about it in a different context, it's ideology. It's, in other words, they're committed to this. The one thing I would suggest is that you find that clip where Biden on the campaign trail promised the little girl he was going to get rid of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
I mean, this is their vision of the world, and they don't stop and think. It's what happens when you disconnect policy from people. What happens to people when you just get rid of fossil fuels or make them vastly more expensive? It's a big reason the price of food is up.
And then the FDA shuts down a plant that makes baby formula, and you have to drive to 10 different stores to find the formula. Meanwhile, the gas is clicking away at $4.95 a gallon. It's just their unworldly self-absorption with the green energy. Jim Talent is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He's always a welcome guest here. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Talent. Come back. I've got Kurt Winstead. General Winstead will be in Congress next year. We'll talk about him and what he intends to do on the next hour of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. General Kurt Winstead, retired from the Tennessee National Guard, joins me. He is running for Congress in Tennessee's 5th Congressional District, which this show covers. Good morning, General Winstead. Great to have you on.
Hey, good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to give people the background. I was all Morgan Ortegas, but then your Central Committee tossed her off the ballot. I know you had no part in that, which is why I'm endorsing you and urging people to get behind you. Tell us a little bit about Kurt Winstead and why you decided to run for Congress. You're in the middle of a very excellent career.
Well, I appreciate that. Last year, I retired from the National Guard. I still have a thriving law practice here in Nashville for over 35 years. Grew up in Tennessee, eastern part of the state. Been living down here for, like I said, about 35 years. Middle Tennessee. Very involved in my community. Loved being in the Guard. That was half my life. And when I retired last year, I was looking for some other things to get involved in the community with, just to give back to my community. I love it. Love Central Tennessee. Love my community. And when they were starting to draw the next 5th District, the new 5th District, I was approached by some friends and people that that knew the district well, and they were encouraging me to look at it. And so I did, and I took a while to think about it, though. I didn't jump into it. This is a big ask. And but when I did decide to do it, when I did decide to get in it, and they drew the lines, and I was inside the lines, I knew I was going to get in 100%. And so that's built me up.
General, I love veterans. Can you tell us about your military experience, when you deployed, what your specialties were? Law practices are interesting to me, too, and we'll come back to that. But talk to us first about your military career.
Yeah, sure. I joined the military when I was 30. Okay, it was kind of late in life, but it was right when Saddam Hussein was invading Kuwait. That was August 2nd, 1990. I was sworn in on the 18th of August, 16 days later. The tough part about that is my wife was 6 months pregnant with our first child. So, she never let me forget that. But it was an opportunity that came up. I wanted to serve my country. My parents were teachers and farmers. They weren't in the military, but it was just an opportunity I didn't want to miss. I really, you know, felt that it was one of the greatest things I've ever had to do in my life was serve my country. So 30 years, about four or five months later, I retired. But I was a JAG officer. So I started as a JAG officer. And during the OIFO, Iraqi Freedom 3, I was deployed to Iraq at Tilil Air Base there in Iraq, and served as the ranking JAG officer there, and also with an engineer brigade doing their legal work in the southern half, basically from Baghdad down on the engineer side we were building bridges and aqueducts and roads and stuff, the infrastructure for Iraq, and we were trying to get them to help us. So that was a big part of it. Then I came back, went to War College, had an opportunity to do that, absolutely loved that. And then, you know, you're going around your career. I'm thinking I become the state staff judge advocate. And I was that for about 6 or 7 years. And then one day, my commanding general, Major General Haston, called me. He says, "I'm going to promote you to a brigadier." And I was like, "Whoa, that's crazy!" So my last 4 years, I was director of the Joint Staff for the Tennessee National Guard. That's the Army side and the Air side, and the combination. And that just capped off a fantastic career. It was such an honor to serve in that role. I loved every bit of it. It was, it took me a while to figure out that one day I was a colonel and then one day I was a general, and everybody thought I was smarter. I didn't think I was.
Now, General, I'm a civilian, so everything confuses me about everything, but I've got a son-in-law and a nephew on active duty in the Navy. So I got to say, go Navy, beat Army. And I know you have to disagree with that, but nevertheless, tell us
go
about
United
the
States.
Go United States. Tell us about the 5th District and which part of it you have lived in and which part of it you don't know well. Mayor Cooper is an old friend of mine in Nashville. I'm real sorry his brother's going to lose a job, but he's lost his job, and now it's going to go it's going to be a red district. Tell us about it.
Yes, sir. It is definitely going to be a red district this time around. There's 6 counties. 3 are whole counties. That'd be Lewis, Murray, and Marshall. And then we have Williamson, Davidson, and Wilson that are about 60 to 70% of those counties. I know all of them very well. There's not any of them I don't know because of basically being in the National Guard and practicing law in this area and living here all this time. I mean, you get to know them all. I live in Williamson County. So Williamson County used to be in Congressman Mark Green's district. Now he has part of it, and the other part is to the 5th. Nashville's been broken up, Davidson County, into 3 basic quadrants, or not quadrants, but 3 sections. And you'll have Congressman Rose will have one part, Congressman Green will have one part, and then the new 5th will have the other part. Wilson County has been broken up to be shared with Congressman Rose and the 5th District. So you got 2 shared with two congressmen, 1 shared with 3, and then 3 of them are just the 5th District. So that's the lower part. Very good. I love it.
What I like to tell people about practicing law in a county or a number of counties, you get to know them all because your clients are all over. What kind of practice do you have, General?
General business practice. It's a lot easier to say what I don't do. I don't do the tort law, don't do the the divorces or the criminal law, but it's general business practice. Obviously, Nashville's been huge in commercial real estate growth, et cetera. And a lot of my partners do that. I don't do that part, but I just do the general business practice part that comes out of it. Really like that. Early on in my career, young, I did litigation defending businesses. And so I used that experience hopefully later on to keep businesses out of litigation because it's not real good for them to get there. But most of my businesses are small businesses. Some of them are larger, but a lot of the businesses that do not have in-house counsel. So I could be kind of act as their in-house counsel. And that's been my probably the 2/3 of my career.
You're describing the quintessential good lawyer to have if you're in a small town or a small city who knows everyone and can keep stuff from the courthouse because you don't want to go to the courthouse. Now, getting to Congress means winning an election. You got to raise money. How's that going? The website is Kurt with a U, Kurt Winstead, WINSTEAD.com. Tells everything all about you. You got a beautiful family, by the way. You really do. Keep working. You got two daughters. I don't know if they're married. Keep working. That's expensive. But
you brought them up. I'm going to brag on them real quickly.
All right.
One of them works for one of them. The older one works for Vanderbilt Health, does community relations stuff. But she's on the board at Operation Stand Down. And I'm very proud of that. Just kind of serving that part of the military on the Operation Stand Down part. The second one is a dentist here in town, and she is a first lieutenant in the Tennessee National Guard Medical Corps. So both of them are kind of doing their own way of service, and I'm very proud of that, to be honest with you.
I'm going to credit Mrs. Winstead more than you, but, you know, that's...
Not only she does that and I do that. Both of us do that.
I do. So that's okay, a great family, a great career, great service to the country. Are you ready to come up and deal with Congress, and how do you raise the money? How do you win?
Yes, sir. The money part, you asked a great question. I was lucky. I got a great team working around me. And obviously, this was a sprint because the lines were not finalized until January. And so we have our primary in August 4th, so it's kind of compact. So I'm proud to say that the first quarter, we had about a little over $1 million in the bank. And 99% of that, 99% was raised in Tennessee.
Wow.
73% of that was 73% in the three counties or the six counties, excuse me. So it was very much an investment in the campaign as opposed to just a donation. Very proud of that fact.
General, what I want to say is thank you for not doing the shenanigans. I know that other people did the shenanigans that threw out Morgan and Robbie and all those people. You were being an honorable guy. You were just going to win on your own. So I think a lot of people that were with them are going to be for you now. And so you're getting an infusion of additional attention and love. Because you didn't play that silly game. And we don't need that in D.C., right? We just need straightforward, straight talk.
I think we'd get along better and get further out in front, too. Be better for our future. I really do believe that. Life's too short to play those games.
So tell me what you want. What's your number one objective when you win this? What do you want to get done? Because you'll be there 20 years. That'll be a safe district through a couple of redistricting. Go ahead.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of issues out there, inflation, you know, gas prices and all that. And those are high on my list. My highest, though, probably is national security. And that's a big umbrella. That covers a lot of things. I mean, you could start at the southern border. That's national security for us. You can start with everything that's going on in Ukraine right now is affecting our food supply, you know, our logistics, everything around the world. We're so interconnected. So the national security part for me is the biggest. And it's one part that I know a lot about just through my experience. But all of it's interconnected. And we get that straightened out. I think it will affect our the border issues that we're having right now. And also the inflation issues and gas prices. I mean, everything will start coming together a little more. So I think that's my main concentration. And also every time I want to take care of our veterans. I mean, those are the ones that we stand shoulders.
Thank you so much for saying that, General Kurt Winstead. Keep coming back. His website again is Kurt with a U, Kurt Winstead, WINSTEAD. General is going to be the next congressman from 5th District in Tennessee. We appreciate you joining us, General. Keep coming back. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Reminder, 2,000 Mules opening in theaters across the United States this weekend as it continues to stun people with how many people want to go and see 2,000 Mules. Salem Media, executive producer of 2,000 Mules. You can also watch it at salemnow.com. Salem used to be a California company. It's not anymore. It's a Texas company now. And lots of people have left California for Texas and Florida because California's fallen apart. One person who stayed is Lonnie Chen. Lonnie and I used to be colleagues on the Salem editorial board, but when Lonnie decided to hang up the hat of editorial and public policy whiz to run for office as controller of California, he left the editorial board. He is in the trenches. He is trying to save California. Lonnie Chen, welcome. I have to begin with the Poynter Institute headline, the staggering $163 billion in pandemic unemployment waste and fraud. That is a staggering amount of money. I'm sure California is responsible for at least 10% of that.
Unfortunately, Hugh, it is. California is actually responsible for anywhere between $20 to $30 billion of unemployment insurance fraud. And unfortunately, it's one of those things where when you look at what happened, it was an entirely preventable fraud. Now, certainly in California, I don't know about elsewhere, but in California, it was entirely preventable. And a lot of it had to do with, frankly, boneheaded decisions during the start of the pandemic, but also just a lack of willingness to make the kinds of changes in our state that are needed in order to protect taxpayers. And it comes down to basic technological, basic systems changes. We had an unemployment insurance fraud that happened because the state was literally sending unemployment insurance checks to people in prison, people on death row, people in China, in Russia. The money went all across the world, and the last place that it needed to go, which is to Californians who actually needed these benefits, unfortunately, those are the folks who didn't get these benefits. So it's a major travesty. It's one that people refuse to talk about time and again, and it's something that we have to get fixed.
Lonnie, you're one of the most respected public policy intellectuals and lawyers in the Republican Party and have been for 2.5 decades. You teach at Stanford Law. You're at the Hoover Institution. The first question out of the box, and your website is LonnieChen.com. I think I got that right. And your Twitter handle is LonnieChen. Why would you leave a comfortable, I mean, wonderful job guiding policy to try and become the controller of a failing state?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, Hugh, the short answer is the only way that we can have impact in terms of actually making a difference and improving the situation in California is to be willing to jump in and to be willing to try and get some of these changes that we've talked about, some of the ways that we can make state government work better for people, and actually go in and try and change the system. And that's what I'm trying to do, running for state controller. It is the chief financial officer of the state of California. It's the person who's supposed to give taxpayers accountability for every single dollar this state spends. And, you know, there was only so much longer, Hugh, I could kind of sit and say, all right, look, here's good public policy. I'm going to write about it. I'm going to try and convince other people to do it. At some point, you have to kind of say, you know what, I'm going to toss my hat in the ring and try and figure out how do we make this state better. I grew up in California, spent a lot of time here over my life. I've lived here for the last 9 years since moving back here with my wife and our family from the East Coast. And I see just how much of a management disaster this state is. And the controller's role is fundamentally about accountability. It's about transparency. It's about good government. And these are the kinds of things I believe that I can make a difference in. So, yeah, you know, it is stepping away from a career and a life that I've loved and hope to go back to at some point. But the reality is to have an impact, you have to step into the arena. And that's what we're doing.
Now, Lonnie, a lot of Steelers fans listen. They do not understand what a controller is or a chief financial officer. Would you explain what the job does? How big is the office? It's been held by Democrats, hacks, for decades. What's it do? How do you change it?
Well, think about the controller's office in California as the fiscal watchdog. Your job is to basically look at spending and say, is the money being spent the way that we're told it will be? The controller's office, believe it or not, he has 1,400 people working in it, 1,400. And it's the job, it's an independent statewide office. So you don't report to the governor, you don't report to the attorney general. You have your own independent constituency. And really, it's your job, first and foremost, to defend taxpayers. I don't know if other states have this role. Some states do, some states don't. But in California, we have $300 billion of spending a year. Somebody has got to be there to watch after how this money is spent. And so this watchdog role is really critical. And unfortunately, for too long, you've had watchdogs who are lapdogs. You have people who, instead of really trying to get after how money is being spent, they are sort of responding to the Sacramento insiders. They're responding to the powers that be by saying, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. as opposed to asking the critical question of why. And I just think, you know, it's time for that to end, given how much money is spent in California. And given the fact, you know, California is the only state in the country where we do not have complete line-by-line visibility into how our money is spent. Even in Illinois, you've got some listeners in Illinois where former governors are sitting in prison. They have more transparency than we do in California. It's unacceptable for as innovative and as large of a state as California is.
Lonnie, let's use the unemployment scam because it's so static. $20 billion. What you could do with $20 billion in California is maybe build some desalinization plants so we don't have a lack of water. Maybe you add more fire protection crews so we don't lose homes in Laguna Niguel. Maybe you have all store, a revamped K-8 that's not ideological. There's a lot that could be done. How would the controller have stopped that from happening if it had been Lan He Chen?
Well, the first thing we would have done is we would have realized, because this is a problem that was identified, in fact, 10 years ago, when we talk about our unemployment insurance system, investigators here in the state of California found during the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009, that the system was built on a technological backbone from the Vietnam War era. Wow. In fact, the programming language that sits on the back end of our unemployment insurance system is programmed in COBOL.
Uh-huh.
A programming language where we literally do not have engineers who can actually work with this language anymore because nobody knows about this thing. This thing is so antiquated and so old. And even then, 10 years ago, we were warned, if you don't upgrade this system, you're going to have a massive fraud on your hands. And so one of the first things the controller should have done was to say, you have to make these systems improvements. You have to go. And there were very specific changes that were identified by the California state auditor. We actually have a state auditor that is responsive to the legislature here in California. The auditor made recommendations 10 years ago and said, hey, you've got to fix this. And so the first thing controllers over the years should have done is to say, you got to get this program fixed, because if you don't, you're going to have a massive fraud on your hands. And sure enough, that's what happened. So this was an entirely preventable fraud, Hugh. For all the people who said, and I've heard all the excuses, okay, oh, the pandemic was awful. There was no way we could have kept up with this. We had to get the money out the door. It's like there's no question the start of the pandemic was an economic calamity. But you could have fixed this before we faced this challenge when times were good. Who was looking out for the California taxpayer? The answer was absolutely nobody. So the controller can make a huge difference in terms of identifying challenges, holding leaders accountable and policymakers accountable for making those changes, and following up and making sure that somebody's actually defending taxpayers, which nobody's doing right now.
Lan He Chen, Michael Schellenberger has been my guest on this program, the author of San Francisco. He's a progressive who has just had it with the wasted money on homelessness. Now, I have spent time with Judge David Carter at Orange County, who's trying to remedy the L.A. There have been billions of dollars voted for by California taxpayers to address homelessness, and still that crisis burgeons. It explodes. It gets worse every time I visit. Does the controller have a role in seeing that that money gets spent on actually housing people?
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, this is an issue. When I go around this state, in fact, I'm headed down to Southern California later this morning. It is the principal issue. When I talk to people down in L.A. County, Orange County, San Bernardino County, Riverside County, they see the homelessness challenge has gotten so much worse. And here's the sad part of it, Hugh. The state of California has allocated over $20 billion to homelessness over the last couple of years. And in the city of Los Angeles, as an example, there is one program that has spent $800,000 per homeless individual, per unhoused individual, to try and house them. And the program, the evidence in terms of the reality of how well the program is done is there for everybody to see. You look on the street, $800,000 per homeless person. The problem has not gotten better. It's actually gotten worse. And so the controller's role, first of all, is in auditing homeless spending. The controller can audit any program of state government at any time for any reason, or any program of local government that uses state money. You talk about K-12 education. That's an area the controller can audit. But with homelessness spending, the first thing we've got to do is get in there and figure out where's the money actually being spent. There's so much money sloshing around that nobody actually knows where the money's being spent. And then the second thing we need to do is we need to move to performance-based auditing. What does that mean? we need to look at each program and say, how well is this program doing? Let's assess it against what the stated goals of the program were so that taxpayers know, are we getting a good deal or a bad deal? In the case of homelessness, Hugh, this is a human tragedy. It's not about fiscal policy. It is. I mean, I guess at some level it is. But it's about, what are we doing to help people who actually need help? Are we providing them with the behavioral and mental health interventions necessary? Are we really thinking about how it is we get them off the streets as opposed to just saying, hey, let's put up housing and worry about this challenge later? So we've got a bunch of things in California we could be doing better, but the reality is nobody is actually looking after whether this money is being spent or whether we're just sending good money after bad.
Lonnie Chen is running for controller in California. I have a two-part final question, Lonnie. We've got about a minute and a half. First of all, it's an open primary. You got to get to the final two on June 6th. Ballots are already in people's possession. How does a center-right conservative get to the final two? Number two, 1,400 employees. Will they follow after years of inactivity? Can you mobilize them? Can you energize them? Can you lead 1,400 career California bureaucrats to get going?
You know, Hugh, I believe we can. I think there's some good people working in the controller's office. We've got a lot of people who have specialty in audit, who understand how to oversee programs. It's about good leadership. It's about strong leadership, and that's what I intend to provide. So, yeah, I do think we can get there. And I also think we can work with the private sector. Public-private partnerships work in California. We haven't seen that as much, but we're going to do that, and we're going to bring that to the fore. In terms of how we win this thing, look, the primary looks very good for me, Hugh. I think I'm going to be in that top two. I'm the only Republican running against four Democrats who divide the field, have regional constituencies, and are all, frankly, out of touch with California. They're more focused on social justice values in the controller's office than competence in the controller's office. And I think Californians now want competence. So for those of your listeners who are in California, I ask you to support me, return your ballot, go to my website. Hugh mentioned it earlier. We've also got a website at chenforcalifornia, chenforcalifornia.com. Take a look at what we're trying to do. And if you're interested in helping out, please do volunteer for the campaign. We've got a good final stretch here. But I'm confident that voters in California want change. They want an outsider to come in and bring accountability and transparency to California. And that's why I think we're going to be in that top two, and we're going to be very competitive. And I think we're going to win in November, Hugh. I think we're going to win the first statewide seat in California in 15 years. But I need your listeners' help to do it. So hop on the website and join us.
Chen for California. Lonnie, keep coming back. Votes are already on people's kitchen tables. Fill them out. Lonnie Chen for controller, Chen for California. Thanks, Lonnie. Come back for the final segment of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. For 20 years, Senator Lisa Murkowski has fought for energy independence as senator from Alaska. I'm so proud to support her in her reelection campaign. But I asked her to come on today because the campaign against American energy independence is driving me crazy. I had Dan Sullivan on. Senator Murkowski, welcome. It's great to have you. Thank you for all you do for Americans who have to fill up their tanks every day.
Well, thanks, Hugh. Good to be on the show. You know, when you think about where we are as a country right now, this, I think, is day number 9 across the country for the highest average gas prices ever that people have seen. You know, this is not some blip out there that is going to go away tomorrow. We're dealing with policies that this administration has put in place that are forcing Americans into this position where they're really having to choose as to whether or not they fill up the car, whether they're able to fill up their fishing boat to go out and provide for their families, or whether they're going to try to stay warm. This is an awful, awful place, and it's brought about by an administration that just has had no foresight when it comes to a coherent energy policy.
Senator Sullivan calls it a war on Alaska. Can you explain, Senator Murkowski, what the administration could do in Alaska to help you and other Alaskans bring more energy to the lower 48? Because I think there's a lot they could do.
Well, the first thing that they have to do is they have to stop shutting down our opportunities to produce. We have the resources, whether it's the oil, the gas, the mineral potential. We have the resources, but as a state that has a great deal of federal land, we basically have to go back to the landlord there for permission, and they have shut the door on every opportunity. And this is not just an opportunity for Alaskans to be more energy independent, but this helps the whole country. And quite honestly, our production can help the world as we're all looking to more secure supplies of energy and what energy security really means. So first, the administration has to stop shutting down our opportunities, whether it is within the NPRA, as they did just a month or so ago, taking more than half of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, offline, whether it's what they did in shutting down the opportunity to advance our leases in the 1002 area of the coastal plain, whether it is what they did just last week in announcing that the Cook Inlet area, which has been the production area for much of our natural gas that provides natural gas for about 400,000 Alaskans in the South Central area, they said no to another round of leases in Cook Inlet. So the first thing the administration has to do is stop killing Alaskan opportunities for us to provide for ourselves and to provide for others. You know, I said yesterday we had a press conference on energy prices and what this is meaning across the country. And some reporter asked, well, you know, is there anything that can be done tomorrow that this administration can do to make a difference? And the first thing people need to remember is, look, if you don't start making a positive difference for the long haul, it's never going to happen. So don't use that as an excuse. But also, if the president were to get in front of a microphone today and say, you know what, given what has happened with unprecedented prices around the country, given the fact that we are that Russia is at war in Ukraine, that we have seen the supply chain disruptions, that we have seen just how critical energy independence is for not only the United States, but other places. We need to do more domestically to produce our own here. If the president were to say that, if he were to suggest that maybe they have missed the mark on an energy policy when it comes to not only energy security, but national security, that sends a signal to the markets that can produce impact right away.
Yeah, energy is a forward-looking market. Senator, we got about a minute and a half. I know you win easily. I know Alaska loves you, but it's the craziest system I know of for voting. I don't even want you to explain it. Just how do people help you in your campaign to reelect? Because we can't lose one of the Senate's most wise voices on energy production.
Well, your words are kind, Hugh, and I appreciate that. We need Alaskans to engage in this campaign. It will be a different format with our ranked choice, and so it will be new, it will be different. But at the end of the day, what we need to do is make sure that experience returns to the Senate, someone who can deliver on Alaska's issues and priorities. And one who is focused first and foremost on the strength of our country. So it's going to be
Senator,
a long campaign, but we're looking forward to it.
Keep coming back. Lisa for Alaska is her Twitter handle. And all of you folks up in Copper River Valley and Anchorage who are listening to me, she is the most effective energy senator in America. Go out and support Lisa Murkowski. Come back tomorrow for the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.